Thank you very much for your attention, and we are now coming to your questions. It would be good if, when you ask a question, you say your name first and then your question. Thank you.
Thank you. This is the conference operator. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touch-tone telephone. To remove yourself from the question queue, please press star and two. Please pick up the receiver when asking questions. Anyone who has a question may press star and one at this time. First question is from David Barma, Bank of America.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. Firstly, on P&C commercial lines, please. Given the change in market conditions since the start of your plan, we could have expected you to reach your target with a bit more support from investment income than technical results. But what we're seeing today is very resilient margins across commercial lines, including XL. Alban, you just mentioned you expect stable margins in 2026. Can you give us some context on the key measures you're taking across the commercial lines book to offset the headline pricing pressure we're seeing in both the U.S. and Europe? And then secondly, on the big solvency ratio benefits you expect from the review next year, where do you see the potential uses of this additional capital? I'm wondering to what extent this gives you more flexibility on the take underwriting or maybe market risk, change your debt structure, perhaps free up cash in some local unit, etc. Any color there would be helpful. And then lastly, on personal lines, the underlying margin deteriorated in the second half of 2025 and were flat compared to the same period in 2024, despite pricing having been ahead of claims inflation throughout the year. So can you give us some color on that, please? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your three questions. I would suggest the first question around P&C commercial lines, which was around the outlook for Europe and the U.S. We start with Scott for 2026, and then we go to Patrick Cohen for Europe. When it comes to the solvency benefits, Alban, if you could take that question, what are we doing when we are back at 232% solvency on the 1st of January 2027? And then, Patrick, if you could talk about the question of the underlying margin in retail over the last quarter. So let's start with commercial lines. Scott.
Thank you, Thomas. Just a couple of comments from an AXA XL standpoint. With respect to the portfolio, we have a very broad, diverse portfolio. To give perspective on the insurance side, we have about 400 different products, and we sell a mix of those products across 26 different countries. So that gives us somewhat unique leverage and to be able to figure out where the margins are and how we allocate resources and capital to execute on those margins. With respect to the United States in particular, the property market, while seeing more price reductions in the fourth quarter than obviously in the earlier quarters, still remains an excellent business, and we continue to write that business and move forward on it. The D&O business, in particular, while has been in a soft market for the last few years, we actually saw prices starting to level out towards the end of the fourth quarter, and we remain sort of optimistic going into 2026 that we're coming out of that softening marketplace and into a little bit more stable to slightly increasing pricing in that marketplace. Other tailwinds for us is obviously we're a pretty large buyer of reinsurance, and some of the pricing on the reinsurance for us on the insurance side is going to help us relative to margin, as well as our expense initiatives and also investment income. So you pile everything together, we remain confident in our ability to maintain our ultimate combined ratios at a similar level that we're currently at.
Patrick, on your.
Thank you for the question. Thank you for the question. I would start by saying that we are super pleased to have record high profitability in commercial line in 2025. This is the reflection of a disciplined growth with resilient pricing that is above loss trend in 2025 and expected to be in 2026. So really an outstanding profitability. We have an all year below 90 combined ratio and importantly, high retention rate. When we look at our markets, the U.K. market has been a little bit more challenging with declining prices in some line of business, but we remain pretty much, very much, I would say, disciplined across the board as I said, resilient pricing above loss trend in all countries, and discipline in our portfolio management with some actions we've been taking. So going forward, we will continue with the same spirit to maintain those margin. We believe this is feasible. We have strong initiatives to further increase our technical excellence and win the preference of our customers. We're focusing on high growth, profitable specialties that could be renewables in Germany or surety in Switzerland and other markets. We are making it even more easy to interact with us for our brokers with straight-through processing underwriting platforms that, you know, in order to win their preference and the preference of our customers. And very importantly, we're ramping up AI capabilities. Certainly, in underwriting, we're super pleased with some use cases we're having, for instance, in the UK that helps our underwriter speeding up data ingestion, triage, and give them knowledge assistance in underwriting. So all of this makes us very confident to keep with the same trajectory of disciplined growth.
Thank you, Patrick. Alban, on the solvency, knowing that solvency is very much also driven by future profit, which is not cash, but you will give some light into that.
Absolutely. And hello, David. So first, the first thing to say is that it is obviously a Solvency II revision. So given that at group level we are regulated with this norm, it impacts our solvency. But a significant number of our subsidiaries have local regulations that are different, thinking about Excel, thinking about the UK, Switzerland, Hong Kong, Japan. So locally, you won't see a change in their solvency ratio, and therefore that will not create for those entities additional solvency and therefore additional ability to upstream cash. And in the European entities, solvency is not always the constraining factor when it comes to paying additional dividend. So what will we use this solvency for? You mentioned two things. One is additional underwriting risks. At this stage, as you know, and you saw that in our Solvency II roll forward, we generate 28 points of capital every year before dividend and buyback, and four after paying dividend and buyback and having our organic growth. So today, capital is not a constraining factor for our growth. And so we are growing on lines of business that we like, where we have the proper profitability, as Scott explained. So we want to grow more, but having more solvency is not a factor in this equation. And it's quite similar on the asset side. Theoretically, you're right, we could take more asset risk, but that's not something that we want. The risk that we take on our in our assets are not driven by solvency. They are driven by our ALM, our strategic asset allocations, and a review of market opportunities. So fundamentally, what does that additional solvency give us? More capital flexibility and ability to deleverage if we want to.
Thank you, Alban. Patrick, on the question of retail and underlying margin deterioration.
Yes, so I would first restate what was said in the presentation in introduction, that this is an excellent year for retail in Europe. Excellent performance, both on the top line, on the fact that we are gaining net new contracts everywhere and very significantly across Europe. And when it comes to the margins, I would stress the fact that our loss ratio is actually down over 2 points, and that's 1 point when you exclude CAT. So that's a very, very strong performance. And again, this trend is reflected in all of our entities, which is something quite quite positive. Obviously, there's always a bit of variability from one half of the year to the other, depending mostly on weather condition and large losses. I think this is what explained the slight differentiation between half one and half two. But overall, it's a very, very strong improvement we had in our loss ratio in retail.
Thank you. I mean, the net new contracts were like 1.7 million, which is not nothing. So very good. We go to the next question.
Thank you.
Next question is from Thomas Bateman, Mediobanca.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my questions. I just wanted to come back to your positive comments on being Chancellor, because the full report yet, I don't think it's out. But I remember looking previously, and you haven't really.
Sorry, we have trouble hearing you.
Many reserves at all.
Thomas, sorry, we have trouble understanding you. I don't know if you are using your headset, but if you could maybe try again. We couldn't understand what you said.
Apologies. I just wanted to go back to the reserving and your positive comments on reserving. Can you give us a little bit more colour there about what you've done? And in particular, if we were to, when the report's released, the full report, what will I see in terms of is from the most recent accident? And the second question is just on the distribution footprint you talked about in retail SME. Not just looking at print here, but can you maybe just give us a little bit of colour on the other parts and extensions you expect to meet the print?
So, Thomas, it was, again, difficult to understand your questions. Let me try and see if we did understand the right thing based on the fragments we heard. So your first question, I guess, was around the reserve prudency that we mentioned. What have we done exactly? And the second one was about distribution footprint in retail and SME. Were those your two questions?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Sorry.
Very good. So I think on the first question, Alban, if you could talk a little bit. I mean, it's relatively simple. If you look at the last year and the NatCat experience that we have had, we could have easier shown better results. We decided not to and instead increase our reserve prudence, but Alban will go into more detail. And then on the distribution footprint, retail and SME, we have the pleasure also to be joined by Mathieu Godard, who has recently taken over AXA France, where we have a very strong distribution footprint and where we're also strong in the development of our footprint. And maybe he can shed some light on where we are and how he's going to continue to do it, knowing that in France, wherever you are in France, you're never further than 4 kilometers away from an agency of AXA. Alban, on the reserving.
Thank you. Hello, Thomas. So on reserving, our consistent approach over time has always been to have a prudent approach in all our lines of business, in all our countries. And you see that through the recurring level of PYDs that we have. We also said that we would manage together natural catastrophes, discount benefit, and PYDs, and that's why this year, given the low level of NatCat compared to our annual budget, we could further enhance that prudence. I think in your question, if we understood correctly, there was also a question of geographic footprint of the ability to release PYD. And that gives me the opportunity to mention that obviously in France and in Europe, we have that, but also at XL, we've had a prudent approach at both XL Insurance and XL Reinsurance. You saw that we didn't release any PYDs in 2025 in those two entities, but we took the opportunity of that good year to further increase the prudence, and and we are now on all our lines of business, and in particular in the long tail lines of XL, at a significantly better level of prudence than 4 or 5 years ago, for instance.
Thank you, Alban. Mathieu, and then I will suggest afterwards, because we talk about agents in France, Patrick can maybe add something around other distribution networks that we have activated, like Correos and Lloyds. Mathieu.
Right. Thank you very much for the question. So, yes, we do have in France a very distinctive, exclusive distribution force that encompasses almost 15,000 people on the ground, should it be tied agents or salaried commercial sales people. And we have continuously invested in this workforce to illustrate. Last year, it was more than 400 new distributors that joined this force on the ground to better serve our customers. So first, we grow numbers on the ground. Then, on top of this, we keep investing in developing their expertise to better advise our customers, should it be on P&C, life and health, but also on very important topics such as preventions, which is critical for the future, and the topic of insurability. So numbers, expertise, but also we do invest in their tools that we put in their hands. And then I would also like to shed a light on what we do with AI. We are currently, we have introduced to improve their productivity a new tool that is based on AI to better interact when it comes to defining the underwriting or answering, sorry, the underwriting questions that they might have. We introduced an AI tool that was deployed very rapidly, probably in a speed that was unseen before, and we have on a daily basis more than 2,000 requests that are automatically answered. So better for their productivity. So we grow them in number. We grow. We keep developing our expertise, and we keep equipping them with modern tools. Thank you.
I would add to this that we have made a number of very significant deals in Europe on alternative distribution from our tied agents that are going to help decisively and are already helping to drive the growth. So to mention a few, the Lloyds banking agreement in the UK, we're talking about a leading a banking network serving 28 million customers, the partnership with Correos in Spain, which is the national post that has over 2,400 post offices, social secretaries in Belgium. All those deals are going to fuel growth. I would add also the social secretary deal in Belgium for serving micro entrepreneurs. And last but not least, obviously, direct. Direct is 18% of the retail business in Europe. With the acquisition of Prima, we're positioned not Italy, but all of our direct platforms that are strong in Ireland, in Belgium, in France, in a strong position to leverage that expertise and the disruption they've been able to create in Italy.
Thank you, Patrick. And we go to the next question.
Next question is from Farooq Hanif, JP Morgan.
Hi, everybody. I hope you can hear me. I just want to go to Alban to understand the investment margin. So when I look at slide 41, I can see there's still a large gap between your reinvestment yield and asset book yield in P&C. And obviously your insurance finance expenses, you're predicting to be a similar level to 2025. Can you talk about that dynamic going forward? So can we take the gap between asset book yield and reinvestment yield and assume that it, for example, closes over a number of years? And what is the kind of outlook for insurance finance expenses? And then allied to that, how come we've not seen the same dynamics in life? And what do you expect for life investment margin? And I just have one more question, which is, can you, a question for Thomas, could you please explain what you mean by enhanced capital allocation? Because it's a very nebulous term. It can mean a lot of different things. But what is it you were trying to say with enhanced capital allocation in the next plan? Thank you.
Thank you, Farooq, for your two questions. And we'll start with Alban on the life and P&C investment margin. I think you have clearly spotted a future potential when you think about 2026 and the next plan, but Alban will explain the detail.
Hello, Farouk. So thank you for your question. You're absolutely right. We see that as a strong opportunity for the coming years, and we do plan to close that gap between the asset book yield and the reinvestment yield. Bear in mind that we have a 5-year duration on our P&C business, so that's probably the pace at which we are renewing our bond portfolio. And and the amount that we invest is very much in line with we invest, sorry, every year is very much in line with that, and we don't want to change significantly our asset allocation, and so this is this target is reliable, I would say. And why don't we see the same on the life side? Simply because, as a matter of principle, you will see the same, because we have the difference, which is even larger between the book yield and the asset yield on the life side, as you see on page 48. But as we said during the comments on the slides, overall, life and health earnings grew at 7%. On life only, we had a significant increase in CSM release by 8%, and so we thought that it was not necessary to have our funds distribute as much as last year, so last year being 24. So that's why you see some flattish numbers on investment income in life, but that's due more to setting money aside rather than not having better yield on our assets.
So, Farouk, on the nebulous term around enhanced capital allocation, to explain it in a simple way, we obviously have plenty of growth opportunities with the exposure that we have now in commercial line, in health and retirement. And so the question is for us, how are we disciplined enough on these growth opportunities to make sure that we grow at attractive returns? And we have put up and enhanced the internal framework around how to understand these opportunities, how to understand their profitability, and how to make sure that we are allocating capital even more there where the growth opportunities are, but where we can also grow at attractive returns. I hope that makes it clearer.
And Farouk, I realize I haven't answered your full question. I haven't answered on the IFIE, the financial expenses, and they are expected to remain stable in 26 compared to 25.
Let's go to the next question.
Forward, is the gap going to widen? Really sorry to interrupt. Is the gap going to widen? So is IFIE growing at a lower rate?
IFIE should be stable, so not growing, and investment income in PNC should grow given the fact that we'll have a better book yield.
As I said to you earlier, Farouk, I think there is a potential for doing better, and you spotted it. Next question.
Thank you.
Next question is from Andrew Crane, Autonomous Research.
Morning, everyone. Three questions. One follow-up from Farouk's. That capital allocation discipline comment, was there any part of your business where you're thinking that potentially the returns are not high enough and that disposals would be the route forward? Secondly, could you tell us what the Solvency II ratio would be in a crisis, a sort of GFC burn down coverage ratio? And then could you, thirdly, and you've talked a lot about it, but about more conservative reserving, could you actually enumerate in terms of what the impact was on 25 from the additional buffers you built into both P&C and life?
Thank you, Andrew. I suggest that I'll take the first question, and Alban, if you could take the second one around the Solvency II ratio in GFC crisis, what's the coverage ratio, and then also the question around what do the numbers of this conservative reserving mean for 2025? So, on the capital allocation discipline, Andrew, this topic is always an ongoing topic. So, when we look at the question of disposal, you know, we have disposed quite a lot to get our business model to a pure insurance player, but also to dispose of all the entities that we have had that were subcritical for us. This is a continuous evaluation, and so if we going forward see businesses where the capital allocation is not the way we want, we do not shy away from disposing it, but at the moment we feel we are at a level where the majority of our business and the large majority of our business is in the right spot. But again, because markets are changing, geopolitics are changing and so on, this is an ongoing evaluation. Alban, on the question 2 and 3.
Good morning, Andrew. So on our Solvency II ratio after a crisis, to be completely honest, we have not done the calculation in a post-Solvency II revision world. But you will remember that what we've been saying over the last years is that a GFC-like crisis would cost us 30 to 35 points. So there's no reason to believe that that amount, that number, would change significantly after the revision. On the prudence that we have in our balance sheet, I mean, we obviously don't disclose any amount, and I think the calculation is quite simple to do when you look at our NatCat and our PYDs on the additional amount of prudence that we could do this year compared to usual.
And not forgetting, Andrew, that certainly at XL we have been doing this for quite some years, because at XL we always had a very clear profit target, and everything that Scott and his team generated beyond went into further reserve strengthening. Can we go to the next question?
Thank you.
Next question is from William Hawkins, KBW.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my questions. First of all, are you thinking that your tech investment spend is currently a tailwind or a headwind to the 6-8% EPS growth that you're delivering? I'm just trying to get clear. Do you think that you're sacrificing near-term earnings growth so you can have a better long-term earnings growth, or are you already taking the net benefit of cost savings from your big IT budget? Secondly, please, the 17 points increase from the review in the solvency, how much of that is coming from own funds and how much of that is coming from required capital, please? And then thirdly, in this presentation, you've dropped any reference to book value growth. I know why, but that featured quite highly in your 2024 presentation as part of a compounding value narrative. So I wonder if you could just talk a bit about how your thinking about that metric has evolved and how you're thinking about performance management relative to that metric, please. Thank you.
Thank you, William, for your three questions. I suggest that on the first one, we let Guillaume Bory talk about it. And as you have heard already in the areas that Guillaume was mentioning about concrete cases, we are working very much on cases that have a short-term payback. When we talk about the second question, Alban, around 17%, what is the split? And then on the third one, around the compounding of the book value, you will also get to it. Obviously, this was affected by foreign exchange, but you can give the detail.
So on technology investment spend, so first, technology investment spend is likely to increase in the coming years. And we are determined to do that because we are convinced indeed that we can extract gains and future earnings from an accelerated investment in AI. We have started already doing that in this plan. And as I mentioned earlier, you do see tangible effects. So it is indeed a tailwind to that extent. We gave you the tangible effect on the loss ratio in P&C, where our accelerated investment in AI has helped us improve the loss ratio by 1 point. On the other hand, we do acknowledge the fact that on several of those cases, profit emergence will take time, and therefore we are extremely committed to our targets, and we know that we have other levers to improve expense ratio in order to more than offset the impact of the additional technology spend. So those other levers, what are they? Stronger efforts on procurement discipline across the board and accelerated efforts in shoring in all of our countries. Those elements are key elements of our efficiency plan. And again, all in all, they will help us to more than offset the additional technology spend we need to do in order to prepare for the future and extract further earnings generation power, in particular for the next plan.
Hello, Will. On the Solvency II review, it obviously depends a bit on the market conditions, but it's 90 to 100% EOF and almost nothing in required capital. And on your last question on book value growth does matter to us and very much in line with what we said, as you pointed out, 2 years ago. So the book value growth is 1.5% for the whole year, but as Thomas mentioned, it's impacted by FX and notably by the US dollar. Excluding that impact, it would have been plus 9%, and therefore very much in line with what we want to do, because we want to grow that that book value number.
Thank you, Alban. Thank you, William, for your question. Let's move to the next question.
Next question is from Andrew Baker, Goldman Sachs.
Hi, thank you for taking my questions. First one, just on the P&C top line, growth was 5% in 2025. Obviously, we've still got some FX, pricing, volume trends. How are you assuming this develops in 26? And then secondly, are you able just to provide an overview of the changes you made to your reinsurance program in 26 and any comments you're able to make on pricing and combined ratio impact would be really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. On the reinsurance program, we let Alban outline these changes. And by the way, to go back to Farouk's question around constant, you know, improvement on capital allocation, this is also part of it. And then on the top line, I would suggest that look, let's have the three market heads, Scott, Patrick, and Mathieu, to give a quick view on what you think 2026 will be. So let's start with the second question, Alban, and then we go to Scott, Patrick, and Mathieu.
So thank you, Andrew, for your question. Fundamentally, we have not changed significantly our reinsurance program for 26 compared to 25. In the arbitrage between lowering retention or attachment points and enjoying better prices, we decided to enjoy better prices. And we could see, for instance, that in property and property cat, prices for reinsurance for our own program were down more than 20%. So that will obviously support our earnings in 26.
Scott, Patrick, and then Mathieu, on what do you think about the P&C top line in 2026?
Yeah, I think for insurance for AXA XL, I think we're thinking 2026 is going to be in line with sort of 2025. And the reason we think that is a couple of things. One, you know, the topic of conversation has been around these data centers, and we're very excited about the opportunities facing us in the data centers. We're one of the few markets that can bring not only the construction capability, ensuring the construction side, but also the operating side to it across not just property, but all the lines of business, casualty, environmental, professional lines that obviously these data centers need globally. And we can deliver that across the whole board. Obviously, we're very carefully managing our aggregations on that, but we also know that we need to be able to deliver in the local marketplace. The interesting thing for us also on those is we've invested quite a bit into our alternative energy business over the last couple of years, and that's going to become an ongoing discussion for the data centers, and we're somewhat uniquely positioned to deliver on that capability that these clients are looking for, both in engineering, claims, as well as underwriting. The last thing I'll say is there's also, you know, the sovereignty boost you see in Europe with respect to the infrastructure build, defense build, et cetera. Those are our clients who will be working on that over the next few years, and we actually consider that a little bit in 26, but we're, you know, see more of that in the future as an opportunity to assist our clients as they continue to grow and build their businesses. That's actually good for us as we are an important partner to them. So, you know, we remain very optimistic about the opportunities facing us in 2026.
When it comes to Europe, we are also confident in keeping the momentum. We see this in the beginning of the year. If I take the example of retail, we're having 200,000 net new customers, so the momentum keeps going. As I said, the pricing environment remains conducive both in retail and in commercial. We have those new sizable distribution partnership that will mechanically improve the growth. Again, Lloyd's, Correos, Prima. And we are working actually a lot leveraging AI to enhance cross-sell and retention in a very good quality portfolio, both in personal and commercial lines. So those are all the levers we're going to pull to keep that momentum.
And to conclude with France, so we see a very good momentum. If I start with retail, we had a historical year with more than 500,000 net new contracts in retail, not only with AXA France, but also with our direct business, Direct Assurance, which is the clear leader in the digital space. And we do that similarly to what Patrick mentioned in Europe, with a very good profitability, leveraging our power, AI-powered pricing tool. So very good momentum and very good outlook on the retail side. And on the commercial side, the current renewal campaign doesn't show any softening on our side, which is a very good news. And as you know, we are very well balanced between tied agents and brokers. So, yeah, very good outlook as well on the commercial line, where we will keep applying our traditional underwriting discipline at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mathieu. And we move to the next question.
Next question is from Will Hardcastle, UBS.
Oh, morning. Thanks. It's Will Hardcastle, UBS. We saw some headlines a couple of weeks ago on the potential LLM distribution risk. I guess, how are you thinking about this risk on the retail and perhaps SME business? And where would you see the greatest risk and opportunity from a geography or line of business? Interested in your thoughts, whether you even view this as a credible risk across Europe or not. Secondly, I recognize you're hinting and you're suggesting that you've looked at the gap between NatCat discounting and PYD, et cetera, to work out that resilience build. But can you try and help us to understand how we can look to add confidence to those words? You know, there's whether that's resiliency build and confidence levels or a ratio you can point to. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. I suggest that Guillaume Bourri is taking the first question around the LLM distribution risk. And I think what's important to see that every technological revolution will potentially bring forward new competitors. But when you look at the last digital revolution in insurance, it has more ended up in a way that these new competitors have collaborated and partnered with the existing players. And I think that's probably what might happen here as well, but Guillaume might have even more insight. And on the second one, Alban, we need to get a bit sharper because obviously that question is coming back on the question of NatCat and PYD. Guillaume.
Thank you very much. So when we look at LLM distribution, we very much see that as an opportunity. For us, it's another distribution channel that is opening up. And we have had a long experience of strengthening our distribution footprint by entering those new opportunities as quickly as possible. This is what we have done consistently over the past 20 years with direct distribution, turning us into a leading direct player. And every time we see that as another opportunity of enlarging, expanding our reach to customers. So yes, it will transform long term probably the way we distribute, but we believe that for us, it's a way again to gain a new channel. How do we make that happen? We have already started working on it. We are currently rolling out across all our retail operations what we call a brand tracker. It's a tool that our teams are using locally in order to identify how we are ranked in those LLMs and what we need to do in order to optimize the way we are presented in those LLMs and in the results that our customers are seeing, so that more and more we are on the first rank. That's what we have done in the past with more traditional search engine optimization techniques. That's what we will do now with LLMs.
On reserves, I will answer in the following way. We design our risk adjustment so that in total, between the best estimate reserves and the risk adjustment, our confidence interval is 65%. And what we will add to that is that we have a prudent best estimate, obviously within the rules of IFRS 17, but a prudent best estimate. So in total, we are above 65% confidence interval.
Good. Thank you, Alban. We have 8 minutes left and 4 questions, so I would suggest we try and cover them all. And I ask the AXA team, including myself, to give short answers. So, next question.
Next question is from Michael Huttner, Berenberg.
And very quick, thank you so much. Really quick, how much capital are you allocating to your life growth? Because I haven't looked at some detailed slides, but apologies, but it's more now the broader topic of pensions rather than protection and unit linked by product. And then the second question on Prima, now you own it and you've had a decent look, how much extra capacity in terms of profit or growth have you got, or how much more confidence than before? Thanks.
Thank you, Michael. So we start with Prima. Patrick is going to answer the question because he's the business owner of Prima now. And while Alban is looking for the capital allocation to the life growth, we'll get that afterwards. Patrick.
Yes, to be very specific, thank you for the question. First off, the performance in 25 exceeds our expectation. GWP is up 39% to 1.8 billion. Prima has captured 40% market share of the direct space, and it's 12% market share of the motor business in Italy. Combined ratio is very solid at 85%. So at this stage, the profit at the MGA level last year was 97 million on a 100% basis, and we estimate the third-party carriers' profit addition being 60 to 70 million. So we intend to recapture this profit over time. So you can consider that is already 110 to 120 million earnings from Prima with a 51% stake.
Perfect. Thank you, Patrick. Alban?
So, hello, Michael. On the allocation to life, first, one thing to remember is that when we say that we generate 28 points of solvency capital, that's after having funded the capital requirements for our developments, including in life. But then if we look at the breakdown of our capital by business line, life and savings is around 41%, and that's the same number as in 24.
Thank you, Alban. We move to the next question.
Next question is from Dominic Homani, BNP Paribas Exane.
Hi there, thanks. It's Dom Homani from BNP Paribas. I'll just keep myself to two, if that's okay. One is, I'm really surprised by the guidance on the insurance finance expense. I don't really understand why it's not growing more. Could you just run through why it isn't growing more, Alban? I would have expected over time at least, the book yield would trend, you know, maybe up to the high twos or something of that level, given your business mix. So is there anything you could say about why it's not growing more in 26 and what the sort of the end state would be once you've sort of washed through the whole book? That'd be great. And then just on cash and debt, Alban, I think you sort of gently hinted that you might consider using your cash position to delever. There's not much debt left coming to maturity or call in 26. Would you rule out liability management exercises? Are you more focused on deleveraging organically and or through maturities or calls? Any color on that would be helpful. Thank you.
Both questions for you, Alba.
Good morning, Dominic. So on the IFE, I think it's very much in line with our plan. If I remember correctly, we said IFE would grow by 800 million, and that was 600 million in the first year of the plan, then 100. So between 0 and 100 for IFE next year is really what you should have in mind. And then on the cash and the deleveraging, I mean, the obvious thing to say is that, as you saw, we have some debt which has lost the benefit of grandfathering, but we still pay a subordinated debt coupon on it. So, and we have 2.4 billion of debts in that category. So it doesn't make sense to keep them forever, I would put it that way.
Thank you, Alban. Next question.
Next question is from James Shuck, Citi.
So your question?
James Shuck, your line is open.
Okay, then we move to the next question and last question.
Next question is from Kailesh Mistry, Deutsche Bank.
Oh, hi. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for taking my questions. So the first one is on Solvency II. Obviously, we've got through the grandfathering. We've had the review out of the way. The business has reduced its risk profile and appears to be improving its prudence. So when we move into the next plan, should we expect you to sort of lower that target range again, or would you stay around what you effectively guided towards for this plan? The second question is on AI and technology. I think Thomas spoke very eloquently about what you've done in that space. Just to sort of nail it down, which of, you know, the applications do you expect ultimately to be competed away, and in which areas do you think you can hold on to the advantages? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So let me ask both questions. I mean, answer both questions. So on Solvency II, I mean, we don't have a target range anymore. So we have a simple rule internally. Everything that is above 200% is good. And whether it's 215, 230, doesn't really matter to us. It's just important that it's above 200. And as Alban explained beforehand, our ability with a higher solvency ratio of extracting more cash is relatively limited because that's not the driving factor, nor is the question around solvency being driven by quite a lot of future profits. So we want to have a high solvency ratio, and it's important that it's above 200%. Then on the AI and technology, I would say you have two areas. One is the areas around efficiency, where you mainly draw on market-based applications, if you think about call center optimization and so on. So in this area, I would say you probably will have difficulties to keep the additional margin for a long time. And then you've got the other areas, which is very much in the pricing prevention space, where I believe that it's very much linked to your own data, your own data quality, which is obviously not a market-driven solution. And in these areas, you will have a lot of the margin that will not be competed away. And obviously, our aim is to spend most of our energy in the second part. Obviously, we have to do the hygiene piece when it comes to, co-pilot and application development when it comes to deploying market-based software in call centers and so on. But when it comes to the question about leveraging data, that's where we'll spend most of our time and most of our money. Very last question, because it is now 30, but I heard that James is back in line. So, James.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'll keep myself to one question. I just wanted to ask you about the journey around hyper-personalization, particularly in retail P&C. I'm keen just to understand, where you are in that personalization journey at this point, and what are the things that you see on the horizon that you're moving towards? And then if we take a more medium-term view, how will that hyper-personalization ultimately evolve? Thank you.
Thanks, James. That's a very good question. When you look today, probably the most advanced business we have within AXA on hyper-personalization is Prima, because they are the ones who have shown us the way, and they will also be the example that exists within AXA for the rest of the AXA group. And maybe, Patrick, if you wouldn't mind to talk a little bit about what Prima has done, so it becomes a bit more, more operational and clear for James.
Yes, certainly. So hyper-personalization for us is one of the levers we have been using to grow and grow profitably, and Prima exemplify this through pricing sophistication, through the ability to put all this sophistication in their rating engines. They provide today a pricing that is very well adapted and very competitive to select the best risk. And they do this with models that enable to have dynamic pricing, so models that are continuously updated. That's on the pricing and growth side. On hyper-personalization, I take your question as well to comment on another areas where we are at this stage experimenting with very promising implementation, which is the one around how do you cross-sell more, how do you retain more customers, i.e. the right offer at the right time to the right customers. We're developing agentic CRM solutions whereby the system collects all the info, all the situation of the customers, adapts and analyze that, predicts the needs of the customer, and in an automated way, develop hyper-personalized emails, hyper-personalized communication. When we implement this in those markets, we're seeing uplifts that are quite remarkable, and we're going to scale that.
Thank you, Patrick. So we have to unfortunately come to the end of this very interesting exchange, because obviously today other competitors of ours are also releasing, and we also want to respect their timing. Thank you very much for participating and for asking your questions. We look forward to seeing you soon again, and hopefully latest on the 21st of September this year, when we are hosting our Investor Day in London to reveal the next 3-year plan, 2027 to 2029. Thank you and have a great day.